Hi there, this is Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you with my friends at Help Musicians. Help Musicians is a wonderful charity that has been supporting artists for 100 years. It supports all types of music creators throughout the UK, including retired musicians. They offer everything from mental health support to training, mentoring, and brand new projects, among many, many other things. And in this episode, I'll be joined by a truly versatile artist. He was in a boy band, he played with the Sex Pistols, and he played with Phil Lynott too. He had a massive number one single with a song called Vienna. He then came back to be part of an even bigger song, Do They Know It's Christmas? Yes, indeed, it's that song you hear down the shops every bloody Christmas. Please welcome my wonderful guest, Mr. Midgeur. Hi, Midge. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast with Help Musicians in mind. How are you today?
I'm very well, actually, you know, considering the madness we've all been through for the last 16, 18 months. I'm good, thank you.
Is the madness getting easier for you?
I think the madness is okay. I think you can kind of cope with it on a daily basis. The thing that is difficult to cope with is this stop-start carrot that seems to be dangled in front of us all about, oh, we've been allowed back out to play, or, you know, we've got dates booked in again, and you get excited about it, and then it disappears and everything shuts down again. And it's a bit like musical snakes and ladders. You know, you find yourself somewhere near the top, and then you slide all the way down the snake again, you're back at square one. So yeah, I think that's the tough part, I suppose. But it's the mixture of emotions, isn't it? You know, even though I hate rehearsing, I did a streamed concert, yeah, and I had to go into rehearsals for that, obviously. And I found myself enjoying it, which is really sad in a way. You know, I found myself surrounded by all the stuff, thinking I'm excited again. So there is that, but also that nagging doubt that, is it really going to happen this time? It's a mixed bag, isn't it?
If you could take me back to your bedroom when you were like 14, 15 years old, what would I see? Would there be posters on the wall? A record player?
Yeah.
Magazines?
I think the record player lived downstairs. I mean, I shared a room with my brother. And I remember at probably 15, yeah, there would have been a Raquel Welsh poster on the wall, and a poster of Easy Rider, a couple of Harley Davisons. Kind of boy stuff, as well as maybe at 15, I think they might have gone by then. There used to be a thing called the Bell Catalogue, which was a music book you could get free. And it was just an advert. It was a series of adverts for guitars and amplifiers. And various guitars would be cut out of this thing and glued on the wall. You know, long before I could get my hands on an electric guitar, I had pictures of them up in the wall. And I had I suppose around that period, favourite album sleeves, you know, the old Beatles, a Small Faces thing, or John Mayall's Blues Breakers, you know, Eric Clapton reading the Beano would be, you know, pinned to the wall. And that kind of, it was a symbol of who and what you were, and also a symbol of development, I suppose. You know, things you'd liked, you know, a year before, but were rapidly growing out of and discovering new things.
Yeah, there's a crossover about that time, isn't there, when you've still got your toys under the bed, but you still want these sort of more masculine things, these ambitions. What sort of ambitions did you have then?
Well, all of that, you know, the idea that the dream, I suppose, of, you know, making music for a living, which really was a fantasy, it was an absolute dream, you know, coming from the very rough working class background that I'd come from in the outskirts of Glasgow. I suppose the big escape there would have been, you know, possibly football, but that was equally difficult to try and, you know, penetrate that particular world. So the fantasy was, yeah, to do exactly what I've done for the last, you know, 50 years. But as I said, it was like chasing mercury, wasn't it? I mean, you reach out for it, and the moment your fingers kind of get somewhere close to it, it shoots off in a different direction. You know, 15, I was in secondary. I went to an academy. I wasn't academic at all. I had a high IQ. And I found the academic side of things not only, you know, difficult, but unbelievably dull. My head was just full of music. So I left school at 15 and got an engineering apprenticeship when I was 16. So I left school very, very early. The thing that was exciting to me was the guitar. That was it. Nothing above and beyond that.
And did you have any musical mates?
Yeah, you do, don't you? Like magnets, you attract each other. You know, there's someone else at school who's got a guitar. And instantly, there's a common bond. Instantly. And it's still that way today. You know, you must get it like I do. You find yourself on the other side of the planet and you see someone who reads the same book as you or someone who's interested and uses the same amplifier. You've instantly got something to sit down and have a chat about. So, yeah, you meet people with, you know, like-minded people. And the only people I could meet, weirdly enough, who had guitars at school were in the folk club, and I was really not interested in folk music. It really wasn't my cup of tea, but you could take your guitar into school. And through that, you'll meet a couple of people who were into the same kind of music, and you'd spend hours in each other's bedrooms playing whatever album it was, trying to figure out the chord patterns and, you know, trying to figure out who's going to play the lead part here.
Yeah.
Kind of Wayne's World of Glasgow.
Yeah. When you say folk music, what kind of folk music, what sort of people were you listening to then?
Well, I wasn't. I mean, I suppose I was... the folk club, or whatever it was at school, or whatever it was called, was very much traditional Scottish music. So it was all kind of finger in the ear, beautiful, haunting, lamenting melodies. But at that moment in time, absolutely no interest to me whatsoever. So I would have been listening to, you know, the contents of the sleeves that I'd pinned to my wall. You know, at 15, it was the British blues boom. It was all about, you know, Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and, you know, John Mayall's Blues Breakers and Stan Webb's Chicken Shack and, you know, all of that stuff. It was a regurgitated blues coming out of, you know, America, but the UK version of it. So that, as an aspiring guitarist, was where you learned your first few, you know, licks and first few riffs. So that was what was kind of feeding my world. And of course, you know, as everyone, John Peel Show. You know, you listen to the John Peel Show. Mm. And I remember sitting listening to it and hearing this new young band they were talking about, whose average age at the time was 19. And I'd never heard anything like this. It's this kind of blues rock band, Free. You know,
oh my God.
Free. Yeah. You know, it was the first time I ever heard them. They were doing a session on the John Peel Show. And it's that, isn't it? Once you hear something, it's kind of like a dog with two bones. You drop what you were listening to and you start seeking out this new thing that's really kind of tickled your fancy.
Did you have a record shop that you could rush out to and buy a Free album?
Well, I couldn't really rush anywhere, you know. You had to jump in a bus and go into central Glasgow to go to a decent record shop. And there was one underneath the big music shop that, of course, on a Saturday, you used to go in, you know, that spotty youth trying to grow their hair, and you'd go in and you'd drool over guitars and Marshall amplifiers and things, and you'd always want to try something out. And they always knew you couldn't afford it, but they let you do it.
Yeah.
And I was one of those annoying brats that would sit and play the same riff that everybody else would go in and play way too loud in the little booth. But beneath that, there's a record store called 23rd Precinct, and you used to go in there and save up your pocket money. And you'd have to choose very wisely, because an album was quite an investment back
then.
It
was. Yeah.
So you had to make sure you were going to get something that not only tickled your musical tastes, but when you put it under your arm and you had the album sleeve facing outwards, you thought that by people noticing this record, it would make you uber cool. So that that factor was massive. You know, you had to be seen as something. You know, this was like wearing an armband. This was like wearing a badge of honour. This said to the world who and what you were at that moment in time.
It was. It was incredible, wasn't it? You know, you felt so proud walking around with, like, a Frank Zappa record under your arm. Or so. It said so much about you.
Absolutely. It separated you from the crowd, although the crowd you hung out with were exactly the same. You all dressed the same and you all listened to the same music.
Yeah. So were your parents supportive of you being into music and not anything else?
It was difficult for them. I mean, they knew I could always sing. I had a voice because that didn't cost anything. They got me a second-hand dance band guitar when I was 10, which I still have. It's acoustic, six-string.
What a great thing.
It's a fabulous thing. I don't have it in here to show you. So they were nurturing that side of it because they knew I was passionate about it. But I got the apprenticeship, which is my father was a van driver, and he instilled in my brother and I the need to have a skill at your fingertips. So be a mechanic, an engineer, an electrician, or a plumber, or something. And that was way up the scale from what he was doing. So we followed that route. And of course, you know, playing in bands and stuff at the weekend, you know, when you're 16 or 17, I found myself at an audition for a band much, much bigger, a well-established band in Scotland, a band called Salvation. I went there with the keyboard player in my band at the time, who I didn't like very much, and we wanted to get rid of him. And we thought this was a nice way of getting rid of him, that he could go and join a different band. So when I went with him to do the auditions, of course, they asked me to play guitar while they were auditioning him, because they were looking for a guitarist. So you see what's coming now.
Yeah.
He didn't get the gig, but they offered it to me. And I had to go home that night and sit with my parents and say, look, this opportunity's arisen. But it means leaving my apprenticeship. I've still got 2 years to go. I could see my father's face drop, but my mother jumped in and she ruled the roost and she said, follow your heart. And it's the best advice I was ever, ever given. And I left the apprenticeship at that point and joined a band full time. The carrot dangled then was the princely sum of £25 a week, which I didn't see for years. It never happened. But God, what a joy doing that for a living.
What a joy indeed. I remember when Squeeze first formed, our first income was £15 a week. Amazing. It was like, when I said to my dad, I'm going to earn 15 quid a week, he said, that's the best thing. But what did your father, he drove a van, who did he drive a van for?
It was a baker's van. It was the United Bakeries in Scotland. So his job, I mean, I remember it vividly. He'd get up at 5 a.m. or whatever and shave every morning, a proper wet shave with the razor blade and stuff, and go out and queue up, because we didn't have a car. Sporadically we had bits of cars that would drive for a couple of weeks and then just sit in a heap because we couldn't afford one. So he'd get the bus to work and he'd drive all day, you know, all around Scotland, delivering bread and cakes and stuff, and then not go home till, you know, gone 6 o'clock at night, which was officially tea time. So we didn't see a huge amount of him, but at weekends he was always there. And it was funny because he was the one with a slightly musical bent. If I look back at it, my grandmother, his mother, when we'd go and visit on a Sunday, they had a piano in their little house, the little flat. And my dad used to sit at the piano and vamp tunes out very much in a kind of Les Dawson style, you know, more wrong notes than right ones. But he obviously had some kind of musical something, and it didn't strike me until, you know, a few years ago that was maybe where it stemmed from, you know.
Yeah. So it feels quite like a very warm household.
Yes, it was. You know, we had nothing together, you know, which was fine. We lived in a tenement, a one-bedroom tenement slum, I suppose, until I was 10. And then we moved into a council house, which had no central heating. And we all kind of lived there until I had a little bit of success and moved the parents all the way to Devon, from the council house in Glasgow to a thatched house in Devon. It was great. You know, one of those boyhood dreams, isn't it? You know, one day, you know, I'll buy you a house. And it came true, you know.
It's like that Peter Kay tour where he goes on tour to buy his mum a bungalow.
Yeah, which is great. And then, of course, everything turns into the kind of Willie Nelson tour when you go out to do a tour to pay the tax man.
Yeah. We've all done that, of course. So what happened to the band?
I joined as guitarist, and it was two brothers who ran the band. That's where my nickname came from. Two brothers, Jim and Kevin McGinley. And as I said, they were quite well known in Scotland at the time, and they were older than me. And when I joined the band, my name was James, Jim. And they said, well, we can't have two Jims, so you're now Midge, which is Jim backwards. So the nickname came first. And I did the Scottish circuit alongside bands like Tear Gas, who were basically, they were the Alex Harvey band, you know, before Alex Harvey took them on. We used to, you know, tour around with the guys who eventually became, you know, the Average White Band. So we'd all do the same circuit. And after a couple of years, the singer left and I kind of stepped in and took over main vocals. We all sang a bit and we dropped the name Salvation and changed our name to Slick. SLIK, yes. And then got ourselves the only record deal we were ever going to be offered in Scotland at the time. Offered a record deal by Bill Martin and Phil Coulter, who wrote and produced all the Bay City Rollers hits. So Slick came out sounding exactly like the Bay City Rollers, mainly because the first big record we had, a thing called Forever and Ever, was all played by the same guys who played the Bay City Rollers things.
No way.
Yeah, we turned up with a 5-ton truck from Glasgow to London to South Moulton Street to come and make our first record. And as we walked in, we could hear the strains of it in the background. And they had the session guys in, you know, Clem Cattini and, you know, all the usual guys who've played on millions of hits. And we heard this thing that sounded just like a Bay City Rollers B-side.
How'd that feel?
Dreadful. I remember Bill Martin taking me out into the middle of South Moulton Street when I complained that we're proper musicians and how dare you and whatever. And he took me out as a very young lad. I'm standing in the middle of South Moulton Street, which was a busy shopping road in London at the time. And he proceeded to scream in my face. I won't use the expletives, but it was basically, you know, you're here, get up there, you've signed the contract, sing this effing song, blah, 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 blah. And I kind of went up with my tail between my legs, you know, horrified that this was happening. And weirdly, his partner, Phil Coulter, who was the musician side of the songwriting and production partnership, he saw that we were a very, very different band. And of course, we ended up playing him and everything else and writing some things. But it was kind of doomed at the beginning. It was doomed from day one. It was 1976. Punk was exploding under our very feet. And the type of pin-up boy band that existed up until that point was about to disappear, and I was about to disappear with it, you know.
Did you go and see any punk bands around that time?
There weren't any in Scotland at the time. Everything we got was through the media. So everything we read about, you didn't see bands on Top of the Pops. There was no real outlet for punk and new wave and early 77 on television. So the only connector we had was the music papers and the odd music programme that was on, but it was still things like the old Grey Whistle Test. So you got everything from, you know, Nepalese nose flutes to whatever latest, you know, hippie trippy stuff was coming out of California.
Sure.
So there wasn't a lot to see. I didn't really delve into it until my phone rang, you know, after the demise of Slick. Slick, we called it a day with Slick when Bill Martin and Phil Coulter wrote a song for us called The Kids of Punk. And it was like the Bay City Rollers had been injected by a tiny, tiny bit of the Damned. It was just dreadful. And the opening line was, "Hey, hey, hear what they say. He looks just like James Dean."
No.
And it was this straw that broke the camel's back. So we broke the contract and said, "Look, I'd rather do nothing than do this. Thank you very much.
I'd rather drive a bakery van."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, at least, you know, I was in charge of my own vehicle, I suppose, if that was going to happen. But, you know, fate intervened and I got a telephone call from Glenn Matlock, ex-Sex Pistol.
What was that meeting like, the first one with them?
Well, it was all done on the phone, really. I jumped on a train because I couldn't afford any other way of getting to London. I jumped on a train to travel down to London to meet up with Glenn and Rusty Egan and Steve New, who they were already a nucleus of a band there. I'd read about them on Sounds in the music papers. They had been hailed as the saviours of rock and roll, and they weren't even a complete band. It was ludicrous. I turned up and went straight to a rehearsal room with them. And we learned three songs. It was absolute chaos. You know, Steve, the guitarist, was 17. He hadn't figured out that if you've got a guitar, you turn the knob on the guitar to 7 or whatever, and you're playing your chords, and then you turn it up to 10 when you're going to do a solo. He would have it on 10 and then run over to the amplifier every time he wanted to do a solo and turn the amp up. And I'm saying, no, 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 no. So I learned the three songs and went out with them that evening. We went to the Angel Islington, where the Police were playing, with Henry playing guitar, you know, before.
Oh, right, that was right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning, and their support band didn't turn up, so we got up and played our three songs. And then we went to a warehouse party, where everyone I had read about in the papers was there. The Clash and the Damned and Susie and Billy Idol and all of these guys. Sid and Nancy were there. we played our three songs there. Then we went to People's Palace, Camden Palace. And I think the Boomtown Rats were playing. So we got up and played our three songs there. I did three gigs in my first day. And then went back to Glasgow and started packing up with a view to moving down to London.
And where did you move to in London?
Well, they found me a little bed set in Maida Vale, which now I'd be very happy to have. But then it was a shock to the system. I'm thinking, hold on, there's no bed in here. And they said, pull the sofa out. That was it. It had a tiny kitchenette with a bath in it, so I could have a bath and fry an egg at the same time. But it was exciting, you know, it was such a buzz. You know, you remember what that period was like.
It was extraordinary.
There was music everywhere, you know, every club and every pub had bands playing. And it wasn't expensive to get in. And it was a real atmosphere you could cut with a knife and take home with you, you know.
Who was managing the band?
It was two guys. One was an ex-roadie and one had done a bit of management, but not really music management. So it was kind of flying by the seat of your pants. I think the band had been offered, you know, big record deals then, because every record label had to have a punk band, didn't they?
They
had to have,
and
they couldn't tell whether it was a good punk band or a bad punk band. They just had to have one. So when I turned up, the Rich Kids were just about to sign to EMI. You know, they had a big deal thrown at them. But of course, you know, the band had to live off of that. You know, there was no money. You did the odd gig when you could.
Did they ever go to the States?
No, they were lined up to go to the States because you guys were doing it. You guys were kind of cutting the path, the clubs. You and the Police were out there doing it. And even early Ultravox, long before I joined the band, were out there doing it. It was IRS was the agency out there, I think it was, that did all
it. It was, yeah.
And so I think that the word was because they thought the Boomtown Rats and the Rich Kids were kind of palatable for an American audience, that we were going to be mega in America. And of course, the moment somebody says that, it's all over, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
of course doomed. It is, yeah.
It's absolutely doomed. So no, we never got to America at that point.
So is it right that then that you kind of joined bands, but you didn't form them?
Kind of. I suppose that's how it looks. I mean, my first band, I suppose, I kind of formed that. That's the one that you meet with when you get other mates with guitars. You find somebody who's got a drum and all of a sudden, you know, you're in charge of that. But yeah, I suppose the Rich Kids, yeah, you're right. I'd never thought of that before at all. I joined established band, or kind of established, semi-established bands. Yeah, that's an interesting thing.
And do you, as a songwriter, sort of go off in the corner and keep yourself company, or did you join in songwriting with other people at that point? Did you co-write?
Well, I think, again, because I still don't think there's a place you can go and learn how to write songs. You have to start by writing plagiaristic elements, you know, tokens to, you know, songwriting heroes, and then eventually grow up and figure out how it works. When I moved to London, you know, Glenn was already an established writer. You know, he'd written Pretty Vacant and he had, you know, co-written God Save the Queen and stuff like that. So he had a grasp on songwriting. And I remember sitting saying to him, but you write songs about subjects, about things. And at that point, my head was full of, well, you just write a hook line and then a lot of nonsense and that's a song. And it took quite a long time, I suppose, being in the Rich Kids and being in that environment. Not all of a sudden I'm surrounded by, you know, Rock Against Racism gigs and you know, stuff about the National Front. I'd never experienced any of that in Glasgow at all. You know, this multicultural city I was living in and all the problems that ensue with that. So all of a sudden I'm surrounded by this, and I wrote my first decent song, I think called Marching Men. You know, never again, never again do I want to hear the sound of marching men. And it was the start of something for me. Something cracked, and I thought, OK, this is something that I can do. There are many things to write about. You know, I don't have to struggle for it. I don't have to invent something to write about, you know, in order to make a song. And I think the idea of just being in a band that wasn't cut out to be a paper cutout pop band, you were allowed to experiment. In fact, in 1978, I brought in a synthesizer to the Rich Kids. I wanted to integrate electronics with the rock instrumentation that they had. Unfortunately, it broke the band up. But that, those ideas kind of came to you
that.
When you were in that environment. You think, yeah, this will be great, you know.
I remember the Mini Moog. Do you remember the Mini Moog?
I do, but they were the price of a small house, Chris.
Nobody
could afford the bleeding things.
But that's the sort of noise that would split up a band.
Yeah, I've made many noises that could split up a band and probably still do.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
As well as these chats with my musical friends, we've also been meeting musicians who've benefited from Help Musicians and whose careers have been saved and supported by this wonderful charity. Whether through financial support, mental health support, training, mentoring, or enhancing skill sets. Meet Yan Fan, a pianist who lives in Leeds, who I met through one of my songwriting workshops for Help Musicians.
I guess it started from the piano. I remember when I was about 6 years old, it was at one of my parents' friends, and we were at this kind of party, and they had a piano there, and I just thought this was a really strange kind of thing. And I decided to climb onto the stool, and I just started pressing a few notes and realized that the notes kind of had a relation. And within about, you know, not too long, I just started picking out tunes that night, very simple ones like Mary Had a Little Lamb and Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and they'd kind of reward me with chocolate. And from then on, my parents became really supportive, and I started taking piano lessons from them, and I progressed really quickly. Within 1 year, I got to grade 5 piano distinction, and in 2 years, it was grade 8 distinction. And that was when I was 8 years old, and when I was 10, I got my first diploma. I had a very open kind of upbringing. It wasn't just, I'm only doing this kind of music, or I'm only doing classical. It was always been a very expansive kind of thing for me. So, yeah, that's where it started. I mean, things like the Beatles, a lot of Richard Clayderman, and he does lots of piano covers of other pop songs, of course, things like that, but kind of like 70s stuff, and that kind of started this thing for me. When I got into the Royal College of Music, I came to Help Musicians just to see if they could support some of my living expenses and some of my day-to-day, you know, costs, and I auditioned for them, and they did, and it was wonderful. I mean, they've given me 2 years of support already, and they invited me to Steinway Hall to take part in this masterclass with one of their other ambassadors, I think, in classical piano, Charles Owen, a wonderful pianist and teacher. So that was that. And then one day I got this email saying that the legendary Chris Difford is doing these songwriting retreats online. Is anybody interested? And if you are, please register early, because we're going to have to draw names out of a hat, because it's usually always oversubscribed. And I thought, I like pop music and I want to do more songwriting. So I just replied saying I'm interested. And then I got onto the course, and here we are. I mean, I think this pandemic has been a bit of a struggle really for everybody, and not just kind of in terms of work coming in, but psychologically, where am I? Which is why I've been really happy to, well, first of all, take part in the retreat, actually. That was a lovely thing to do. And also to get the chance to just learn lots of new pieces for piano. Always look at the bright side and be positive and find new ways of motivating yourself, and never ever forgetting my love for music. And I just can't see myself in a world without music. I don't think I'd survive.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you, or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. So, your jump into Ultravox, how did that happen?
That was the demise of the Rich Kids kind of spurned creativity, I suppose. I had my synthesizer, my killer synthesizer that split the band up, and my guitar, and a head full of ideas. And, you know, half the band hated this thing and half the band loved it. And the half the band who loved it was Rusty Egan, who was running a little club in Soho at the time called Billy's. Yeah. He ran one night a week and he called it the Bowie Night. And this is like 1978, beginning of 79. Punk was in its, you know, we were getting third and fourth generation punk bands coming on. It was the fashion, the look was in high street shops, and, you know, you could buy ripped T-shirts and bondage trousers and all of that nonsense. And when it gets to that point, the instigators of the movement move on. They don't want to be any part of it. The Bromley contingent kind of reverted back to the first loves, which was David Bowie and T-Rex and Roxy Music and a little bit of music coming out of Europe, you know, kind of electronic music. And Rusty had this little club that he was playing this music at, and we used to go down there and hang out, this, you know, blossoming scene. And Rusty, who talks for the UK, he just talks incessantly, throws ideas at you. And he said one day when we were walking through Notting Hill, he said, "Wouldn't it be great having a band with all our favourite musicians?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You know, Billy Currie, keyboard playing Ultravox, the guys from Magazine." And I said, "Yes, stop, let's do that, let's do that." It was a means for me to get in the studio and do more production, you know, learn more about how it all worked, because that was my big thing. I wanted to be behind the controls, not necessarily behind the mic. And that was the foundations of Visage. We wrote this stuff, we created this stuff when we could. It was difficult and it was long-winded because Ultravox, as they were at the time, were still touring. Magazine were still touring. The Rich Kids still had a couple of gigs to do contractually and whatever before we finally walked away from each other. So, yeah, that was it. And through working on the Visage project, I saw Ultravox come back from an American tour, the tours that you were doing, a broken band. John Fox, the singer, left. Robin Simon, the guitarist, you know, met a girl there and stayed on. So the nucleus of Ultravox came back, including Billy Currie, who I'd been working with.
That's
and
amazing,
it was Rusty who said to them, "You know, what are you doing?" And they said, "Well, we've got no idea. We don't know if we're going to carry on or not." And they said, "Well, you need to get Midge in the band." And that was it. I jumped at the chance. I loved what the band were doing at the time. So I had a home for my synthesizer.
That's amazing. And was fashion very important to you?
I think the style was important, especially a lot of the kids who were going to the Blitz. It wasn't always about, you know, wearing your granny's wardrobe and having way too much makeup on. You know, there were a lot of stylish people there who would go to, you know, thrift shops, go to Oxfam and come out with a D-Mob suit and just look fabulous in it. A little bit of taste and a lot of necessity, because nobody could afford Jean-Paul Gaultier outfits or, you know, Anthony Price suits like Brian Ferry. So it took a little bit of inventiveness and creativeness. And a lot of the kids who went to Billy's and subsequently the Blitz Club were all from St. Martin's School of Arts.
Yeah.
So they were all fashion designers or photographers or, you know, hat designers. They were all into the arts. So they had that fantastic sense of style. And that permeated its way through into, you know, what you were wearing when you did videos or photo shoots and whatever.
I mean, I remember seeing the video for Vienna and thinking, my God, this must have cost millions.
Cost £17,000.
Is that all?
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been a lot, of course. But
it was a lot at the time. And we had to con the production company doing it, who had already done a video on 16mm. We set the parameters of what we wanted. We didn't want it shot in video. We wanted it on 16mm film, so it was grainy and haunting and atmospheric. We wanted to crop the screen top and bottom, make it look like CinemaScope. We wanted to go from black and white to colour, you know, the shadows on the cobbles, all of that film noir imagery. So we'd already done a video like that, a thing called Passing Strangers, for a previous single. So that when it came to doing the Vienna video, besides, you know, Russell Mulcahy, the director, you know, thinking, you know, great, Vienna, I can see it all now, the gondolas, the arches, the little Britain. We're going, no, that's Venice. It's a different city. You know, he was Australian, so we can forgive him that. So besides, you know, that, the template was already there. And the record company didn't want to pay for a video because Vienna was already number two in the UK charts.
Yeah. Job done.
And I remember having a conversation about it, saying, but with a video, instead of flying us out to Milan or Berlin or whatever every weekend to go and promote this on some crappy Saturday night television, We can send them the video. Then we're in control of what it looks like. And it gives them five minutes of great television that they don't have to make, you know.
It was an incredible tool, in those days.
They didn't see it. It was at a time before it was written in your contract that you had to make videos. It wasn't in contracts. So we borrowed the money. We got a bank loan and we borrowed £17,000. No. And we made the video. And then, of course, when they saw the video, they said, oh, right, OK, well, yeah, we'll pay for that now. We should have charged them double.
But, you should have done.
But, you know, we were so pleased with the results of it because it was the first of a quality little mini movie. That's what, there was no storyline. It was just us in Vienna or whatever. Lots of nice images, a series of stills glued together. But there was a quality to it, you know.
Yeah. What do you feel today when you're on stage playing acoustic guitar, maybe in a club or something, and somebody asks you to sing that song?
You know what? It's too easy to turn around and say, well, God, I've done so much better, which I think I have. But you understand that at least 50% of an audience, certainly in concerts, in, you know, theatres or whatever, they don't want to be there because they've been dragged there by the significant other half. So they're there fulfilling that particular duty, you know, and maybe the only song they know of yours is Vienna, you know, or Dancing with Tears or If I Was or whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd just be a complete dick to turn around and say, well, I'm not playing that. And I know there are many artists who do that. I think, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have something that's embedded itself in someone else's brain or heart and lasted all this time, it's your duty to go out and give it the best shot you can, whichever way you're doing it, you know, whether it's acoustic guitar or a full-blown orchestra. You know, you give it your best. I remember taking my children when they were young to see, I live in Bath, to see the pantomime in Bath. And there was a famous actor was leading this cast in the pantomime. And he obviously hated it. He didn't want to be there. And he walked through the parts and he stumbled over his lines because he couldn't be bothered learning them. And I thought, that's exactly what an audience would see if I did that to a piece of music. I would be letting myself down and they could see that I was not interested in doing it and I wouldn't blame them for getting up and walking out.
That's a really great answer. I mean, I remember for a long time being not too interested in singing Call for Cats every night on a tour. And then I sort of started just sort of mimicking myself. And then Glenn said to me, you know, you're forgetting who you are in that voice. Bring that voice back to the stage. And once I did that, I owned the song again.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, you've got to remember that every audience member, everybody who ever bought or listened to a piece of music that you've written probably gets the same buzz. It means as much to them, something you've done, as everything that inspired you to do what you do.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, you know, if I had gone to see David Bowie and he walked his way through a set, you know, I would be devastated.
Yeah.
I mean, devastated. So, you know, you owe it to people to give them what they want. There's a great example. I remember reading about Elton John doing an entire new album at, I think it was Crystal Palace or something.
It was Wembley.
And irrespective of how good it was and how well he played it and how much effort he put into it, the audience weren't happy because they still wanted to hear, you know, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road or you know, Goodbye Norma Jean or whatever it was, Daniel. They wanted to hear what they knew, you know, and there's a way of doing that and still satisfying yourself as an artist and performing new material or darker material or album tracks that maybe they don't know so well. So you just have to think about it a little.
Absolutely. So in your career, what would you say was like one of your peak experiences, one of your high points? Would that have been Live Aid or would that have been something less visual?
You know what? It's the invisible stuff. It's the stuff that people don't see. Because, as I just said, that we all started doing what we're doing because you loved what someone else did. That's what got you into playing the guitar or writing songs or singing or any of that stuff. So yes, of course, you'd think, yeah, Live Aid, standing on stage with a band, belting out, you know, Vienna, the obligatory Vienna, you know, doing that and relishing the moment, you know, just basking in that moment of glory. It's everything you ever hoped it would be. But the reality is, it was things like Kate Bush agreeing to sing a duet with me or sitting in, you know, what was my little house in Montserrat in the Caribbean with an acoustic guitar and electric guitar, and Eric Clapton and I swapping guitars, playing old blues tunes. Nobody saw it, you know, but I did. You know, they're like massive highlights. You know, yeah. I had Mick Ronson's guitar in my wardrobe in my first little flat in London for 6 months. Guitar that he used on the Ziggy Stardust album that I had watched as a punter, watching in the Glasgow Apollo, seeing him playing those fantastic notes on that very guitar.
They are
magical moments. They are highlights to me.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that Live Aid kind of killed off the punk era? Because it seemed like after that, you know, even Adam and the Ants went down the pan.
You know, I think it was a weird one. I mean, it was a massive highlight, but it was also the death knell for bands just playing regular size venues, because all of a sudden, big bands would go out and do, you know, megadoms.
Wembley.
They play Wembley. They play stadiums. They do stadium tours, and all of a sudden, you were watching a screen or a micro dot, you know, way in the distance, and the sound would be weird because when the wind would blow, the sound would move around in waves, and it was a totally different experience. So it had its good elements and it had its bad elements. So it double underlined the end of a certain amount of things. I mean, even to the extent that bands like U2 decided, well, we're not going to do stadiums on this next tour, we're going to play smaller, more intimate places, because it must get like, you know, you're painting by numbers. You know, one stadium looks like another stadium. The backstage area looks exactly the same. You walk on, there's a duplicate set of equipment because you left Rio last night and you're now in Sydney. Yeah. And the only way to do that is to have two sets of stage set and two sets of equipment and whatever. The nearest audience member is half a mile away.
I know, it's a struggle.
How can they relate to me? You know, so it was an odd one, I have to say.
Yeah. And where do you think one of the low points must have been in your career so far?
Oh, I've had loads of low points. You know, we don't live in a, you know, in a bell jar. We're not protected from life because you've happened to have a few songs that people like, or you've been on television a few times. It's that old thing about, I think the general public thinks if you've been on television, you're a multimillionaire. And it's just not the case, you know.
Not the case.
It's really not the case. It's a, you know, it's a struggle. It's a struggle to get there and a struggle to establish yourself. But it's an even bigger struggle to try and maintain what you have and maintain the quality and the standards that you've tried to keep. It's a very difficult thing because you're at times surrounded by people who are not looking after your best interests, who are trying to guide you to do whatever. I remember going through the 90s, which was a particularly bad period, surrounded by people saying, you should be a DJ. What? What? I should be a DJ. Doing what? Playing records in a club? Yeah, yeah, electronica. You could be the grandfather of electronic dance music. I hate dance music. Why the hell would I do that? I'd rather go back to driving that bakery van, you know, like my dad did. So there are moments where you think, oh, God, it's just, I don't get it. And people don't get me. And I understand that. Where there's a period where songs almost became redundant. Right. It was all about the BPM. It was all about the sounds. It was all about the atmosphere. It was all about making music that you could play to a bunch of people in a field off their faces, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And in order to do that, you became faceless. I thought, well, I just don't fit. It doesn't work for me. And I made a conscious decision not to let DJs come in and remix my music, because that was being cited as the path to commercial success. You get this key DJ, he comes in, he puts a synthesized bass right through all your chord changes, you know, so everything clashes, and then you put that out. And I think, well, no. And I suppose the real low point was I found myself going back to my management office with all my golden platinum records up in the walls and having to kind of explain who I was to, you know, the receptionist, because, you know, the new breed, you know, the Blur and Gorillaz and Elastica and whatever, their stuff was up in the walls, and that's all that people were talking about. All of a sudden, I was the old guy. You know, I was last week's thing, last year's thing, last decade's thing. And that, you know, no matter how strong you are, you're not impervious to that. It really takes its toll. So I found myself drinking too much. I found myself with my career on the skids. I found myself, you know, half £1 million in debt. And then when my father died, That was it. I went down the drain. I had some kind of, which I think now when I look back at it, some kind of breakdown. You know, I had to I had to own up to not being this megalithic character who could carry all this weight on my shoulders, which I'd done for like 20 years, and admit that I was human, you know, and I was frail, and I, you know, I was open to whatever abuse is around and be affected by that. So I found myself kind of on my knees at one point and having to start from scratch. And it was quite possibly the best thing that ever happened to me.
Absolutely, it is. And it's a great thing. I think one of the low points for me would have been not having Mick Ronson's guitar in my cupboard. How did you get it, for God's sake? Did you nick it off him?
He was producing the Rich Kids. He produced the Rich Kids album. Because my instigation, I thought, I just want to meet the guy. I want to hang out with him. I want to talk to him, and we'll talk guitars and stuff. And he wasn't really interested in talking guitars, but he was a lovely, lovely man. And he was travelling a bit, and he'd said, "Look, well, you know, I've got my guitar, you know, and I'm going to be away for like 6 months, and I don't know if he was touring or producing someone else or whatever." But he said, "Well, do you mind if I leave it in your flat?" And I'm going, "Please." Yes, you know, I mean, what a thing to show your mates when they pop round. It was amazing. Like Spinal Tap. You open it up and they'd all look, and I'd say, "You can look, but don't touch it. Don't touch it. You can't touch." And it was that guitar, and it was all beaten up, because it was a black Les Paul Custom, and he had picked all the lacquer off it, so it was just down to the wood. It hadn't been varnished or anything. It had no knobs on it. It was all hanging, but it was the guitar.
Yeah. So I'm doing this podcast with Help Musicians, which is a charity that was formed 100 years ago by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams to help their friends who didn't have any money at the time and even couldn't afford to be buried. So they sort of clubbed together and helped them out. So in the last year, they've doled out over £17 million to struggling musicians around the country, which shows an amazing amount of empathy. Do you feel that there's empathy at all in the music industry?
Someone told me a story about a Latin American artist who was huge, and he'd been huge for many years. And he went in to see his friend, who was the head of the record label. And he said, "Look, what's happening to my career? Nothing's going on." And the guy picked up an orange and he cut it in half and he squeezed the half of the orange until all the juice had come out. He said, "This half was what you were and this half is what you are now," and dropped him. And you think, that's kind of what it's like. The industry itself was guilty of throwing the baby out of the bathwater. They were guilty of not signing things that didn't fit the demographic. Not because the music wasn't good, or the songs weren't great, or they weren't great singers, but because they were too tall, or too small, or too thin, or too fat, or the wrong colour, or the wrong sex, or whatever it was. It had to fit the pop template. And since the advent of streaming, or Napster, I think it was, record labels don't have the wherewithal to sign the radical artists, the more interesting artists, the oddities, all the things that make music move forward, you know, all of the stuff that you think, that's never going to happen. And then it happens, and all of a sudden it has a million followers. It's got a million people trying to emulate it. And they're scared to sign things that are different. So they try and make everything the same.
Sure.
And when that career is kind of over, there is nowhere for them to go. If you were a car designer, the top of your tree, the top of your career was when you hit 35 and you were designing cars for Lamborghini or whatever, they wouldn't throw you out to get the 20-year-old in. They would keep you on because you have all the knowledge. You have all the information. You've been through it. You've fallen down the sinkholes. You've risen to the top of the ladder. You have all of that experience. And our industry throws it all away. And it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So anyone who helps and listens to struggling musicians is doing a fantastic job. My old friend, Mick Carn, who was a bass player in the band Japan, found himself absolutely penniless just before he died. And he got some help. They had a fund there to help get him back from Cyprus he was living in so he could live back in the UK to get treatment and whatever for his illness. And he was lucky. He was one of the handful of people that I know who's actually received something back from someone in the industry for all the years and all the effort they've put in to try and keep this industry buoyant and alive. So yeah. Anyone who helps is doing a phenomenal job.
It is an incredible thing, but there are copyright issues where, you know, Universal, Sony, people like that are being very greedy and not being very helpful with the artists like possibly you and myself. But also streaming seems to be terribly unfair. The balance is very unfair. And some of the students that I've worked with in the last year, you know, are crippled by that.
Yeah. It's a pittance. It's an absolute nonsense. And again, as you point out, labels are being greedy. Labels, you know, struck deals with, you know, the likes of Spotify and the streaming sites, and the artists and the musicians and the producers get nothing. You have to be streamed millions upon millions of times to go out and buy a loaf of bread, and it's just not good enough.
Have you seen an uplift on streaming for yourself?
Maybe. I mean, my demographic is a bit like yours. They're not overly au fait with modern technology. They're old school. They like to have something in their hands. They like to buy a record. Look, they like to have a piece of vinyl. Look at that. Look, record day vinyl. They like to have something in their hands. They don't want it sitting in the ether. They don't understand downloads and stuff, a lot of them. So I haven't seen a massive upsurge in streaming. Weirdly, a David Bowie track I covered back in the early 80s was used on a video game, a very famous video game. And an entire different generation of kids all discovered this. And it's the top streamed track that I've ever been associated with, because people who understand streaming and how to do it fell in love with this piece of music. So that's way above and beyond anything I wrote.
That's incredible. Midge, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat today.
That's a pleasure. No, thank you for doing this, because there are so many people out there right now, not just the musicians, but the entire infrastructure, struggling to try and get something happening. You know, we know the science. It's the rules that keep changing. The science doesn't really change that much. And, you know, if you can have thousands of people standing watching a football match, surely you can have thousands of people watching some music. But yeah, you are doing a phenomenal job by just hosting this and fronting this and keeping this going.
Thank you so much. You filled me with joy.
It's my job.
And sing in Vienna.
Still.
Thank you so much.
That's a pleasure, Chris.
Well, what a fine man he is. Thank you so much, Midyear, for being so open and honest here on my little podcast. It seems like we have so many things in common. Although I have to say, I've never played Wembley Stadium in front of the entire world. But there is still time, I guess. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode, and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.